Hello and welcome to this podcast where I ask you to journey with me in a fraught journey to discover the origins of the five ancient principles of chemistry. And you'll join with me as I look around, probably a bit different from the way that you would look, seek knowledge, and search for these principles, yet fail to find them. This is Peter Hill Explains, where I discuss things scientific. And in this podcast, you'll join with me almost as a co-pilot as I scrub around or scurry around knowledge and try and find out this idea. Now, let me first start off. I'm reading a book called Affinity, That Elusive Dream by Mi Kung Kim. And it's a fairly thick tone, several hundred pages. And this is what the book reviewers say. From Ambics, Ursula Klein says, Kim's book is a major contribution to our historical understanding of French chemistry in the 18th century, which will be taken into account by all historians of chemistry working on this subject. Another review of this book. By Robert Fox, Times Higher Education Supplement. The argument is one of the engrossing subtlety, one that future historians of 18th century physics will have to take very seriously indeed. And in general, this particular book is a deep tome, and it describes the sort of time leading up to the event of chemistry, and the action where it all takes place is in France. France, for some reason, is a leading hotbed of pre-chemistry. Now, the five principles of chemistry, one wants to actually get these little gems, like the five principles of chemistry, are definitely by Dalton. And he basically sets out chemistry as we know it today, saying that there are such things, and we won't get the five principles out of it, there's such things as atoms. Atoms have particular properties, and you start off a chemical reaction of a fixed number of atoms on the left-hand side, and you rearrange them and you get a chemical reaction. That's our modern idea of chemistry. And so starting from Dalton's theory, you get our modern chemistry. So leading up to this is a very interesting time indeed with chemistry. And reading this book, you see that chemistry doesn't have a fixed origin. It's actually mixed up with alchemy, which is the idea that I can mine a useless ore and I can transform it into a valuable one. And people did do that in many ways. They got dirt and heated it up and actually got iron out of it. So one would think that you could, there must be some sort of similar process that you can get dirt or iron, get gold out of it. That was alchemy. There was also medicine, which is where you get various potions together and cure people. The idea that you would eat things up. And so in medicine, this goes right back to the Hippocratic Oath, Hippocrates and Galen and various other things. There are these emergence of these separate medical disciplines swirling about the place. There's religious effects coming into medicine. So all this is in our pre-chemistry. And there are other fields still to do with basic manufacture of goods, which involved chemistry. So all of this was swirling around in the 18th century. So this is 1700 to 1799, the 18th century. If you go, this is Australia is founded in this time, and you have various things. And in this time, you want to actually pick out little gems of knowledge. So the gem of knowledge for me is that we have this gem of knowledge in teaching chemistry, which is Dalton's five principles. There must be another five principles that is mentioned time and time again in this book. I should say that I have struggled in this book to actually have those five principles listed and actually gone on the internet. And all the internet does is go back to this book, yet very clearly there are these five five principles. So going at the start of 1700, we have the Aristotelian view going forward that there are elements, but the elements are earth, fire, water, air, and ether. Ether not on earth, ether up in the heavens to allow things to travel in circular motion, but these come together and the various compounds you mix together, and there's various processes. I think there's distillation and solutions and various things come together. And in this period, people are starting to break away from this idea. But there were these five ancient principles allowed us to get access to this ancient world. So our five modern principles allow us as a little key to get to our future chemistry. It sort of summarizes up what future chemistry is and goes forward. These are sort of like a touchstone of the ancient world to work what it is. And I'd love to know it, but I haven't been able to access it to go through. And so another sort of touchstone to go through is try and work out geopolitically what was happening in Europe. So in this Europe, there's really the changing of the guard from the French continental empire to the British Empire. British Empire was Victorian going forward, but the Seven Years' War resulted in a change, a landmark change of power from France to Britain, the expansion of France to Britain, the waning of the Spanish power, and the rise of the United States and other intellectually driven things. You've got the significantly in this era, the distribution of printing presses around the place, and printing and communication is coming up. And so you're looking for this period, the Seven Years' War, where Britain allied with Prussia, and everything looked as though it was going France's and Russia's way, and at the last moment it's swapped and went the opposite way. But there are these underlying principles of the Seven Years' War. So the Seven Years' War resulted in France ceding its properties in North America to the British, which then led on to the American Revolution. But this is a very important thing: France giving up its occupation in India and Africa and all over the place. All this went down. Even such things as the massive fort in Dunkirk, which could be seen from England, allegedly was taken down. So there's a major change of the guard with the Seven Years' War. And essentially the Seven Years' War was a naval engagement between the French and the British, and there was a whole series of deep insights, sort of keys, if you like. But essentially, it all boiled down to the fact that Britain could produce more ships at a higher rate, having access to materials. This is wood and flax, and they could just pump out more and more. It's a bit like the T-34 tanks. The Russians were able to overrun the Germans with just producing a bit more, but back at this time the British were able to just man and produce more ships. And British Navy was interesting, the philosophy of the British Navy. And you can see this forward, that essentially the occupation of Australia was a British Navy strategic ploy based on the idea that they'd be able to get rope and wood from the South Pacific with a base in Australia or Sydney. And bear in mind, I'll just digress for the moment, that when Sydney was founded up near Botany Bay, they went off fairly soon with some sort of mad, more irritating elements of the founding colony in ships, and went to Norfolk Island to harvest the Norfolk Island pines and to try and grow flax to make ropes for the Royal Navy. And they founded a second Sydney. So this is something that people don't know. But getting back to this, this is more in the idea of saying, look, if I have this nodule of knowledge, what these five principles are, I'll be able to actually unlock what was going between all these. I can read up to five different groups all vying for power. And it's essentially, one of the nodules of interesting truth is that the group of doctors relying on more on the line of chemistry which lead to modern chemistry were able to hit upon a few more effective drugs. So they had a drug which cured the king. So the king obviously would have been one of the Louis. And that meant that they just went up, began to go up notches, so to speak. People who didn't have chemistry actually made worse, according to this book, made worse tasting medicines. And so there was basically a taste factor, a yuck factor. Even though none of this group has chemistry that we would recognise. So there ends my discussion at this point in time of the five principles in 18th century. I'm here in the navigating the information seas of 2018, trying to work out what's going on. I'd like to continue from here. Just bear in mind that this is my cardiac rehab, and I'm just trying to podcast fluently enough to get structures together and to summarise and be able to move forward, bring an audience with me. So if you imagine I'm boarding you on a ship, an intellectual ship, so to speak, looking back at the origins of pre-chemistry and alerting you to the fact that pre-chemistry, unlike the other physical sciences, has got a history in magic and medicine and magic and medicine awe. And I've got you on board that ship and saying, look, there are these key navigation lighthouses. One we see in the far distance where things go forward is five modern principles, but making sense of the waters of the early 18th century with all these different things coming forward. And these stories which don't seem to together is this other lighthouse, and I can't find it, but I know it's there, and these five ancient principles. I should at this point in time, just before we leave this ship, say that pre-modern chemistry, there's a critical point where people at the end said metal plus oxygen goes to metal oxide, is a basic thing, plus heat. Whereas previous to that, they said metal goes to dirty metal plus fire. This calyx is the dirty, corroded metal. Fire is phlogiston. So they actually thought fire was actually a substance. So it's all a rational viewpoint, but they had made an initial big bet on on fire was an element, which sort of makes sense from the Aristotelian view. This is the last gas. So that's a very important thing to get across, but to able to give people a sense of the foundations seem this scrambled egg of ideas, and I'm really hoping that these five principles there, and to give you an idea back in that history, the idea of these nodules or these gems of information I've also told you about in the 18th century, that key switch from French continental power as the successor to Spanish power, and how England reached ascendancy as a naval power as a critical point trying to get into there. And there's chemistry described there, the way that the English were able to manufacture compasses and manufacture ships with copper nails, which didn't decay and fall apart. So the French had ships, and they tend to fall apart a little bit more. So there's sort of chemistry lurking in there, and these principles coming in here. So I've got you on that ship, and we're going to leave that ship, so to speak, and say, well, I've tried to build that ship. I haven't built it very well, and we're in these modern times. And I'm doing this strange thing of reading these really obscure books by MIT Press. I'll just read you another thing for Chemical Heritage. Splendid. Affinity, that elusive dream, is an asset to our understanding of this concept and this period in the history of chemistry. Well, it is an asset, but it actually misses some key points. Now, I should give you my origin. I sort of grew up and pursued knowledge and actually went down a rabbit hole of a PhD where I actually wrote a thesis and began to construct information. So that's where you stop and you start to build information, do experiments, and build a theory for yourself. And this is very much the writing of a thesis. And one of the things is that you proceed in a short time down a rabbit hole and you get a complete understanding. It's up to level, but it's not a 360 degree understanding of areas that you miss. And of course, as a communication point, this is down that line. And believe it me, I remember getting online on the web pages, the web page. I think the internet at the time, first time I looked at it, was two or three pages of links long, and there was no structure, no browsers. It was just a page of links which you could click on and start to read, and people would tell you about interesting links. So this is pre-internet. So at this stage, what had happened is that the tradition of scientists writing books, and books is a communication process, lived on in the internet. So if you look at Galileo, Newton, everyone, part of being a scientist is writing these long tomes and publishing it. And there wasn't necessarily an institution. There were publishers and general ideas. The institutions came later. So these institutions harbored and looked after, nowadays, harbor and look after these people, produce these tomes. Now, what has happened is that what I used to do is go to the library, get an interesting area, and if I wanted to be right up to date, I would start to get a few theses of people who've recently studied the area and just pour through those theses. And I must admit, I haven't encountered other people. There are people I would read about, say, I can remember various people writing military theses, and I would contact them and get a copy of their thesis and read through it. And a well-written thesis is a very good way because it explains, gives you the background history and tells you the most modern thing. It's a very careful, it's a great thing. But I must admit, I haven't met too many people doing that. As I've been sick the last year or so with heart thing, I've had to slow down. And there's my favourite textbooks, which there's almost two grades of textbooks. There's the textbooks written to be sold to an education system, so it really talks about the syllabus and skills. Or occasionally there's textbooks, usually US and old German textbooks, by people who are skilled in the art. I have to mention Hecht and the physics books. And these are fantastic books because you read through and there's little asides, and little asides you can research and discover things. So for me, I was first off of quite sick reading through these textbooks and going through these textbooks. I suppose the most fascinating thing for me is to find a deeper understanding of mass. I sort of had understood the idea of mass, a kilogram, from various different aspects. I was interested in the Higgs boson and the scalar fields and stuff like that, and the equations associated with it. But missing was that background gem of where did mass come from. And it was in a very good textbook by Hecht, who actually said, oh, look, it's Giles of Rome who came up with it. And I was able to study into that and study into the mad world of the religious and civil state, which was wrestling with a culture of fraud. Basically, everywhere was fraud and modern science erupted from this. And so as these books got too heavy for me to hold, I was going on to other books. And then when I went for my second heart operation, my daughters went around to these bookshops and bought these really obscure books. What happens is that an academic will produce a book, go for a run, say of 10,000, be able to sell 1,000 upwards, and we'll have 9,000, and those 9,000 will be bought at cost off by booksellers and distributed amongst various specialty bookstores, and you'll have a bookstore full of these books, which are sitting somewhere between a thesis and a popular book. And it's only when you read a couple of them and it's explained how we came across it that you say, aha, this book is very good, but it's missing a key point. So I read a book about the transit of Venus and had all the history right, but it actually never actually got into how the parallax is generated, because you can actually walk up and down the plane above and below the ecliptic by actually walking up and down the planet. So travelling from London to Tahiti, you're at different heights above the ecliptic. And of course, looking at Venus by parallax is in between. That will actually walk Venus up and down the girth of the Sun, which will mean that it will take different transit times going across. And there is various things that I had read about the physics of the liquid drop theme. So I had this background, and this background was actually missing in this book. And so it's, I suppose, one of the things which makes these books inaccessible, that you have to read a large number of them to actually pick up an area. And I'd say I would often read one of these books without an agenda, and they would take me on journeys. Or a thesis which I did read is about activity theory and Vygotsky, and that was an eye-opener, and that was a core of knowledge which was outside the education system that I was getting into. It never erupted, and people basically were quite dismissive of it. Yet if you go down these cores, these sinkholes of knowledge, and if you go down a sinkhole of knowledge, you can find these gems of knowledge. And so that sort of explains this book, and I suppose my sense that this is a gem I want to get to. I might even write to this author eventually and say, look, I just tried my hardest, but I couldn't do it. And they're generally very good if you write to an author and they say, look, how come people aren't reading all my books? So I've read a few books, say, on Spartan Kings or on gravitational waves, and sort of written to someone and said, look, this is a fantastic book, I like it, and then you've got some really original ideas in it. And they'd say, yes, I still can't sell any of the books. So at this stage, I have, just in summary, I've taken you on an 18th century ship and given you a sense that in the vapours out there, there's the threads of ancient history coming together, and at the end, we have Dalton and modern chemistry going up, and I need this other island, this other point, these principles to get me to go across, take you across there. Then I've taken you into modern times of this unusual thing that I think a lot of people don't necessarily go to university libraries and pick up theses and just churn through them just to try and get a deeper understanding. I think there's a social aspect to it. So that's our second point, these sinkholes. And then I'm just going to try and finish this off with a general idea. Another picture of what has emerged is this, as we call the internet, the information superhighway. So I can get a large quantity of information, but I'm someone who's got this sinkhole or deep core knowledge of someone who's stationary, has written a book, and you've read up, and then you've got internet, which you can leap between article and article. And you can see sometimes that the internet knowledge is very well connected and between things, and it's almost like a game show or a popularity quiz where something's very popular and it comes up. It does have some other aspects, some angles, but in general, there's a sort of a consensus knowledge in the internet. So it's very interesting to get across, and you can actually, if you come up against something you don't understand in these core things, you can reference the internet and get across. And of course, if you're someone like myself, you can say, oh, look, eventually there are other aspects, other technologies in the internet, like podcasting. I think I can actually start to put a podcast of ideas and get different aspects of the idea. So not the idea itself, but someone's actually coming in and looking at the idea and discussing it. So that's a podcast there. There's other maths and technology technologies which I think are out there. So we've got these sinkholes, this if you are almost like a glowing electronic circuit connecting ideas across, and but that only contains brief information. It also astoundingly provides exact copies of these books and manuscripts, so it's a great resource in that way. Then we come across what's in the actual education system, and the education system is sort of like a bound theme park, a model reality of the actual complexity of, and for good reasons, but it's a modelled, theme-parked image of reality. So we had in Sydney, before it was shut down, Old Sydney Town, this is a historic theme park where the actual deep knowledge is not there, but there's an image of it and people and the script, and there's a way of moving through it. And essentially, tour buses arrive at the start, and by the end of the day, the people can actually tick off what they've been in it. And so, again, there's this and a lot of people live within that theme park. And so, for me, I've got these sinkholes, which I work within, and that means that I'm sort of a bit different in terms of trying to negotiate the my experience of the internet is slightly different. And then again, there are people who live within these it's sort of like almost a theme park, a Luna Park or a Disney theme park. In America, there were these Western theme parks or Menlo Park, where they actually recreate the experience, and there was things were very limited, and one can understand it. It's just you can well imagine there's a large step of difference away from it. So from the cultural difference, from education, which is an image. Or a theme parked, a themed construct of reality, which we look at, and then the internet, and then basically these knowledge miners who go down these holes, subterranean holes, and look beneath the surface, and come up and have this sort of gentle approach. They're not. They have an opinion, but it's not an opinion that you vote on and build a party on and push people around or declare your rights because of this opinion. These are more just the experience of actually being beneath the surface, and knowledge is so intense that it means that you come up and you are still taking in information. And not necessarily pushing things away. So you've got these people, or myself, interacting with knowledge this way, and then you've got the education system, which is doing its own thing. And it could well be that these theme parks will eventually walk off further and further away from, as they form an image of what they're doing, which is really formulated from the surface knowledge, they'll walk further and further away into a region of conflict. So this is my podcast, and on this I'm practicing, I suppose, a breathing, some simple thing of breathing, being able to put coherent thoughts together continuously for a period of time, just practicing it. So I'm not there yet. And finally, to actually produce a bit of structure to these really rather complex ideas. And so the structure here is that 18th century, a feeling of the current day with not an insistence, but a suggestion that there are different experiences of knowledge, from that deep knowledge to the customary knowledge, and the interplay between, about how you can actually build a fortification or an existence hemmed in by customary knowledge, and people who are deep knowledge miners come around and ask different questions. And there's this basic conflict there. Thanks for listening. This is Peter Hill Explains. Keep on doing science.